ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय So, today is the appearance day of Sri Rukmini, and so this morning I'm going to give the inside story on Rukmini. So, but before I do that, I'm going to just give a little background information for the benefit of the new devotees and just to refresh everybody's memory. But I will deliver. I'll give you the inside story on Sri Rukmini. Okay, so Rukmini was the daughter in this earthly pastimes of King Bhishmaka, who's also known as King Vidarbha. The kingdom was known as Vidarbha, so he was also known as Vidarbha, but that was her father. And her father wanted her to marry Krishna, but she had an elder brother whose name was Rukmi, and you know, he's a powerful personality as well. So he wanted her to marry Sisupal, who was a Kshatriya at the time, and he was, you know, powerful Kshatriya, actually, Sisupal, and he was related to Krishna. It's mentioned in the Bhagavatam that he was related to Krishna as a cousin. I can't remember the exact genealogical thing, you know, whose brother and what, you know, mother, father, but he was related. So it doesn't mention in the Bhagavatam how, you know, she didn't like Sisupal or anything like that. I mean, it just doesn't mention anything about her attitude towards Sisupal at all, really, whatsoever. But it does mention that she fell in love with Krishna. She hadn't met him. She hadn't even seen him. But she just fell in love with Krishna by hearing about him. She would hear about Krishna from different sources, and she just fell in love with Krishna, and she decided that she wanted to marry Krishna. So this was a problem for her, because you know, here it was, the father was in favor of that, but the elder brother, who was very influential in the family, very powerful and influential in the family, he had this other desire. And, you know, it doesn't give a lot of, like, explicit details, but it could be something like the father was kind of getting older and this brother was a full-grown man himself. And so there was, you know, there was like a tension there. And she, of course, wanted to marry Krishna, so she didn't know what to do. You know, back in those days, the girl didn't just kind of, you know, it wasn't like today so much. It was, you know, the girl was kind of like a more humble, quiet position in the family, and you know, she couldn't just kind of stand up to her brother and say, hey, you know, I want to marry Krishna, just butt out. You know, that would not have worked. It didn't, you know, it wasn't how things worked back in those days. So she just was quietly, you know, like quiet desperation. She was saying, man, I want to marry Krishna. So she devised a plan herself. She decided to send a letter. So she wrote a letter to Krishna expressing how, you know, she was wanting to marry him, and she was in love with him by hearing about him, and like that. And she sent this letter via a messenger, and a Brahmin, I believe, and was just hoping that it would get to Krishna and that he would respond. So that done, time was marching on, time's passing, and so the appointed time for her to marry Sisupal was approaching, and she, you know, there was no response. So she was fearing that maybe it didn't get to him, maybe it got to him, but he just didn't want to, you know, he just didn't want to do it. Well, she didn't know what to think, really, and she was in a lot of anxiety. And so then she, they do certain things. I think they were going to visit a temple. Help me out with the details, right? The temple of Lord Shiva. Yeah. Sorry? Which? Durga, yeah, sorry. Thank you. Temple of Durga. Because that's the tradition before the girl got married. So, and then, and still at that point, she didn't know. You know, she didn't know what was going to happen. And then Krishna appeared on the scene and kidnapped her at that time, right? When she was returning from the temple of Dwarka or on the way to the temple of Durga. Coming back from the temple of Durga, Krishna kidnapped her. And at that time, what? Twitching in the eyes? Oh, there's some sign. Anyway, so at that time, all the other princes were there because that was supposed to be, you know, it's like they're getting really close to the marriage there, you know, to Sisupal. So Sisupal was there along with Jarasandha, I believe, and a lot of other very powerful Kshatriyas. And they were all there to help Sisupal celebrate his marriage, basically. So then all of a sudden, Krishna swoops in and he just kidnaps. And just swoops her up, just kidnaps Rukmini, and all these princes, you know, went to attack Krishna, and Krishna had, Prabhupada said this, not in the Krishna book, but Prabhupada revealed this detail here in his garden here, that Krishna had Rukmini drive the chariot. So Krishna had Rukmini drive the chariot, and meantime he was fighting them all off. And you know, they were powerful. Jarasandha was a very formidable adversary. But Krishna was able to, you know, defeat all of them. It was a serious battle there. But what happened was that at some point, these other kings and princes, they were able to see that this is very serious, and either you know, we're at risk of losing our lives here, and it doesn't seem like this guy's worth losing our life for. So we'll just, you know, we've done enough. You know, we've done enough to be friends here. You know, so to show our friendship. So they kind of backed off at some point, but then Rukmi, the brother, he decided to. He said, no, this is totally unacceptable. You know, if all these princes and kings, if they couldn't defeat Krishna and retrieve Rukmini, then I'm going to have to do it myself. And, you know, in a moment of bravado, he took a vow. He said, either I'm going to go out there and I'm going to, you know, defeat Krishna and get my sister back, or I won't return to my kingdom of, I think it was called Kundina. You know, I'll just live someplace as a hermit or something like that. So he took that vow, you know, and saying that he would do it, you know. So he got up an army, and he went after Krishna. And when he finally caught up with Krishna, he was, you know, a bunch of insults back and forth. Like, well, not back and forth. He was insulting Krishna. Then there was a bit of a fight, and Krishna easily defeated him and was going to kill him, actually. But Rukmini, you know, it was because it was her brother, after all. So she felt very compassionate towards her brother. She was sympathetic, and she begged Krishna not to kill him. So Krishna didn't, but he disfigured him. He kind of, like, took his sword, and he kind of cut his hair all over him, so it looked very funny. Which he figured, for a Kshatriya, that was, like, almost a punishment equivalent to killing him, because if you humiliate a Kshatriya, that's pretty, you know, it's difficult for them to deal with. They have a lot of pride and like that. So, and then Balaram showed up, and he chastised Krishna. He's the older brother, so he can, you know, he chastised Krishna. He said, how could you do this? He's a family member. He's your brother-in-law. How could you do that to your brother-in-law? So, to make Rukmini kind of feel a bit, support her and make her feel a bit better. After he finished talking to Krishna, he spoke to Rukmini and he said, actually, don't be too disturbed by this, because I can't remember he made some points, but the basic gist of it was that he's not worth kind of really lamenting about too much, because he's a bit of a rascal after all. So don't take it too, and he, you know, made some philosophical arguments presented as well, but don't be too upset by it. So that passed, and then Krishna, of course, was then married to Rukmini, and they resided in Dwarka. She was the principal queen, of the 16,108 wives that Krishna had, or queens. She was the principal one. And she had 10 sons, of whom Prajumna was the chief. And she, in general, she was like very submissive towards Krishna. And so much so that on one occasion, Krishna wanted to see, and he wanted to try to see if he could get her angry, you know, get her, kind of get some emotions out of her, like that. So he devised a plan, you know, to say certain things to try to get her riled up a little bit. And somehow, it really didn't work. Well, it did work, but, you know, he wasn't able to really get her to get angry, but he did get some, you know, a response, and he was very satisfied with the response. And as I mentioned, the inside story, what I meant by the inside story is that, you know, if you want to know the, like, really about somebody, if you hear about them from somebody who's very confidential, a very confidential associate, then you'll get, you know, very information you wouldn't get otherwise. So, I mean, I'm going to read a few paragraphs about what Krishna says about his wife, Rukmini, after that little encounter. So that's the inside story. You're hearing about Rukmini from the person who is not only the Supreme Personality of Godhead, that would be good enough, but from also happened to be her husband. So here's some information about Rukmini from the Supreme Authority, Krishna, who happens to be her husband. So this is a reading from the Krishna book now, the chapter called The Talks Between Krishna and Rukmini. So Prabhupada says, after hearing Rukmini's statement and her clarification of each and every word which he, Krishna, had used to arouse her anger and love toward him, Krishna addressed Rukmini as follows. My dear chaste wife, my dear princess, I was expecting such an explanation from you. And for this purpose only I spoke all those joking words, so that you might be cheated of the real point of view. Now my purpose has been served. The wonderful explanation that you have given to each and every word of mine is completely factual and approved by me. O most beautiful Rukmini, you are my dearmost wife. I am greatly pleased to understand how much love you have for me. Please take it for granted that no matter what ambition and desire you might have, and no matter what you might expect from me, I am always at your service. And it is a fact also that my devotees, my dear most friends and servitors, are always free from material contamination, even though they are not inclined to ask me for such liberation. My devotees never desire anything from me except to be engaged in my service, and yet, because they are completely dependent upon me, even if they are found to ask something from me, that is not material. Such ambitions and desires, instead of becoming the cause of material bondage, become the source of liberation from this material world. My dear chaste and pious wife, I have tested, on the basis of strict chastity, your love for your husband, and you have passed the examination most successfully. I have purposely agitated you by speaking many words which were not applicable to your character, but I am surprised to see that not a pinch of your devotion to me has been deviated from its fixed position. My dear wife, I am the bestower of all benedictions, even up to the standard of liberation from this material world, and it is only I who can stop the continuation of material existence and call one back home, back to Godhead. One whose devotion for me is adulterated worships me for some material benefit, just to keep himself in the world of material happiness, culminating in the pleasure of sex life. One who engages himself in severe penance and austerities just to attain this material happiness is certainly under the illusion of my external energy. Persons who are engaged in my devotional service simply for the purpose of material gains and sense gratification certainly are very foolish. Material happiness based on sex life is available in the most abominable species of life, such as hogs and dogs. No one should try to approach me for such happiness, because it is available even if one is put into the hellish condition of life. It is better, therefore, for persons who are simply after material happiness and not after me to remain in that hellish condition. Material contamination is so strong that everyone is working very hard day and night for material happiness. The show of religiousness, austerity, penance, humanitarianism, philanthropy, politics, science, everything is aimed at realizing some material benefit. For the immediate success of material benefit, the materialistic persons generally worship demigods, and under the spell of material propensities, they sometimes take to the devotional service of the Lord. Sometimes it so happens that if a person sincerely serves the Lord and at the same time maintains material ambition, the Lord very kindly removes the sources of material happiness. Without finding any recourse in material happiness, the devotee then engages himself absolutely in pure devotional service. This is Krishna speaking the whole time. Lord Krishna continued, "My dear best of the queens, it is clearly understood by me that you have no material ambition. Your only purpose is to serve me, and you have long been engaged in unalloyed service. Exemplary unalloyed devotional service not only can bestow upon the devotee liberation from this material world, but it also promotes him to the spiritual world for being eternally engaged in my service. Persons who are too much addicted to material happiness cannot render such service. Women whose hearts are polluted and full of material desires devise various means of sense gratification while outwardly showing themselves to be great devotees. My dear honored wife, although I have thousands of wives, I do not think any of them can love me more than you. The practical proof of your extraordinary position is that you had never seen me before your marriage. You had simply heard about me from a third person, and still your faith in me was so fixed that even in the presence of many qualified, rich, and beautiful men of the royal order, you did not select any one of them as your husband, but insisted on having me. You neglected all the princes present, and very politely you sent me a confidential letter inviting me to kidnap you. While I was kidnapping you, your elder brother Rukmi violently protested and fought with me. As a result of the fight, I defeated him mercilessly and disfigured his body. At the time of Aniruddha's marriage, when we were all engaged in playing chess, there was another fight with your brother Rukmi on a controversial verbal point, and my elder brother Balaram finally killed him. I was surprised to see that you did not utter even a word of protest over this incident. Because of your great anxiety that you might be separated from me, you suffered all the consequences without speaking even a word. As a result of this great silence, my dear wife, you have purchased me for all time. I have become eternally under your control. You sent your messenger to me, inviting me to kidnap you, and when you found that there was a little delay in my arriving on the spot, you began to see the whole world as vacant. At that time, you concluded that your beautiful body was not fit to be touched by anyone else. Therefore, thinking that I was not coming, you decided to commit suicide and immediately end that body. My dear Rukmini, such great and exalted love for me will always remain within my soul. As far as I am concerned, it is not within my power to repay you for your unalloyed devotion to me." So, that's Krishna's opinion of Rukmini. Pretty elevated. So, looks like we have quite a bit of time left. I didn't think I would have time, but I guess I'll read some of the conversation leading up to that. And so we could relish that as well. This is what Krishna said to Rukmini to start off with. He goes, "My dear princess, it is very surprising. Many great personalities in the royal order wanted to marry you, although not all of them were kings. All possessed the opulence and riches of the kingly order. They were well-behaved, learned, famous among kings, beautiful in their bodily features and personal qualifications, liberal, very powerful in strength, and advanced in every respect. They were not unfit in any way, and over and above that, your father and your brother had no objection to such marriages. On the contrary, they gave their word of honor that you would be married with Sisupal. The marriage was sanctioned by your parents. Sisupal was a great king and was so lusty and mad after your beauty that if he had married you, I think he would have always remained with you just like your faithful servant. In comparison to Sisupal, with his personal qualities, I am nothing. And you may personally realize it. I am surprised that you rejected the marriage with Sisupal and accepted me, who am inferior in comparison to Sisupal. I think myself completely unfit to be your husband because you are so beautiful, sober, grave, and exalted. May I inquire from you the reason that induced you to accept me? Now, of course, I can address you as my beautiful wife, but still I may inform you of my actual position, that I am inferior to all those princes who wanted to marry you. First of all, you may know that I am so much afraid of Jarasandha that I could not dare to live on the land, and thus I have constructed this house within the water of the sea. It is not my business to disclose this secret to others, but you must know that I am not very heroic. I am a coward, and am afraid of them. Still, I am not safe, because all the great kings of the land are inimical to me. I have personally created this inimical feeling by fighting with them in many ways. Another fault is that although I am on the throne of Dwarka, I have no immediate claim. Although I got a kingdom by killing my maternal uncle Kamsa, the kingdom was to go to my grandfather. So actually, I have no possession of a kingdom. Besides that, I have no fixed aim in life. People cannot understand me very well. What is the ultimate goal of my life? They know very well that I was a cowherd boy in Vrindavan. People expected that I would follow the footsteps of my foster father, Nanda Maharaj, and be faithful to Srimati Radharani and all her friends in the village of Vrindavan. But all of a sudden I left them. I wanted to become a famous prince. Still, I could not have any kingdom, nor could I rule as a prince. People are bewildered about my ultimate goal of life. They do not know whether I am a cowherd boy or a prince, whether I am the son of Nanda Maharaj or the son of Vasudev. Because I have no fixed aim in life, people call me a vagabond. Therefore, I am surprised that you could select such a vagabond husband. Besides this, I am not very much polished, even in social etiquette. A person should be satisfied with one wife, but you see, I have married many times. I have more than 16,000 wives. I cannot please all of them as a polished husband. My behavior with them is not very nice, and I know you are very much conscious of it. I sometimes create a situation with my wives, which is not very happy. Because I was trained in a village in my childhood, I am not well acquainted with the etiquette of urban life. I do not know the way to please a wife with nice words and behavior. And from practical experience, it is found that any woman who follows my way or becomes attracted by me is ultimately left to cry for the rest of her life. In Vrindavan, many gopis were attracted to me, and now I have left them. And they are living, but are simply crying for me in separation. I have heard from Akrura and Uddhava that since I left Vrindavan, all of my cowherd boyfriends, the gopis, and Radharani, and my foster father, Nanda Maharaj, are simply crying constantly for me. I have left Vrindavan for good, and now I'm engaged, and am now engaged with the queens in Dwarka, but I am not well behaved with any of you. So you can very easily understand that I have no steadiness of character. I am not a very reliable husband. The net result of being attracted to me is to acquire a life of bereavement only. My dear beautiful princess, you may also know that I am always penniless. Just after birth, I was carried penniless to the house of Nanda Maharaj, and I was raised just like a cowherd boy. Although my foster father possessed many hundreds and thousands of cows, I was not proprietor of even one of them. I was simply entrusted to take care of them and tender them, but I was not the proprietor. Here also, I am not the proprietor of anything, but I am always penniless. There is no cause to lament for such a penniless condition. I possessed nothing in the past, so why should I lament that I do not possess anything at present? You may note also that my devotees are not very opulent persons. They are also very poor in worldly goods. Those who are very rich, possessing worldly wealth, are not interested in devotion to me or Krishna consciousness. On the contrary, when a person becomes penniless, whether by force or by circumstances, he may become interested in me if he gets the proper opportunity. Persons who are proud of their riches, even if they are offered association of my devotees, do not take advantage of consciousness of me. In other words, the poorer class of men have some interest in me, but the richer class of men have no interest. I think, therefore, that your selection of me was not very intelligent. You appear to be very intelligent, trained by your father and brother, but ultimately you have made a great mistake in selecting your life's companion. But there is no harm. It is better late than never. You are at liberty to select a suitable husband who is actually an equal to you in opulence, family tradition, wealth, beauty, education, in all respects. Whatever mistakes you have made may be forgotten. Now you may chalk out your own lucrative path of life. Usually a person does not establish a marital relationship with a person who is either higher or lower than his position. My dear daughter of the king of Vidarbha, I think you did not consider very sagaciously before your marriage. Thus, you made a wrong selection by choosing me as your husband. You mistakenly heard about my having very exalted character, although factually I was nothing more than a beggar. Without seeing me and my actual position, simply by hearing about me, you selected me as your husband. That was not very rightly done. Therefore, I advise you that it is better late than never. You can now select one of the great Kshatriya princes and accept him as your life's companion, and you can reject me. Krishna was proposing that Rukmini divorce him at a time when Rukmini already had many grown-up children. Therefore, Krishna's whole proposition to Rukmini appeared to be something unexpected, because according to Vedic culture, there was no such thing as separation of husband and wife by divorce. Nor was it possible for Rukmini to do so in advanced age, when she had many married sons. Each and every one of Krishna's proposals appeared to Rukmini to be crazy, and she was surprised that Krishna could say such things. Simple as she was, her anxiety was increasing more and more at the thought of separation from Krishna. Krishna continued, "After all, you have to prepare yourself for the next life. I therefore advise that you select someone who can help you both in this life and the next life, for I am completely unable to help. My dear beautiful princess, you know that all the members of the princely order, including Sisupal, Shalva, Charasanda, Dantavakra, and even your elder brother Rukmi, are all my enemies. They do not like me at all. They hate me from the core of their hearts. All these princes were very much puffed up with their worldly possessions, and they did not care a fig for anyone who came before them. In order to teach them some lessons, I agreed to kidnap you to your desire. Otherwise, I actually have no love for you, although you loved me even before the marriage. As I've already explained, I'm not very much interested in family life or love between husband and wife. By nature, I'm not very fond of family life, wife, children, home, and opulences. As my devotees are always neglectful of all these worldly possessions, I am also like that. Actually, I am interested in self-realization. That gives me pleasure, and not this family life." After submitting his statement, Lord Krishna suddenly stopped. The great authority Sukadeva Goswami remarks that Krishna almost always passed his time with Rukmini, and Rukmini was a bit proud to be so fortunate that Krishna never left her even for a moment. Krishna, however, does not like any of his devotees to be proud. As soon as a devotee becomes so, by some tactics he cuts down that pride. In this case also, Krishna said many things which were hard for Rukmini to hear. She could only conclude that although she was proud of her position, Krishna could be separated from her at any moment. Rukmini was conscious that her husband was not an ordinary human being. He was the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the master of the three worlds. By the way he was speaking, she was afraid of being separated from the Lord, for she had never heard such harsh words from Krishna before. Thus she became perplexed with fear of separation, and her heart began to palpitate. Without replying to a word of Krishna's statement, she simply cried in great anxiety, as if being drowned in an ocean of grief. She silently scratched the ground with the nails of her toes, which were reflecting reddish light on the ground. The tears from her eyes were pink, mixed with the black cosmetic ointment from her eyelids, and the waters were dropping down, washing the kumkum and saffron from her breasts. Choked up on account of great anxiety, unable to speak even a word, she kept her head downward and remained standing just like a stick. Due to extremely painful fearfulness and lamentation, she lost all her reasoning powers and became so weak that immediately her body lost so much weight that the bangles on her wrists became slackened. The chamara with which she was serving Krishna immediately fell from her hand. Her brain and memory became puzzled, and she lost consciousness. The nicely combed hair on her head scattered here and there, and she fell down straight, like a banana tree cut down by a whirlwind. Lord Krishna immediately realized that Rukmini had not taken his words in a joking spirit. She had taken them very seriously. And in her extreme anxiety over immediate separation from him, she had fallen into this condition. Lord Krishna, naturally very affectionate toward his devotees, and seeing Rukmini's condition, his heart immediately became softened. At once he became merciful to her. The relationship between Krishna and Rukmini was as Lakshmi Narayan. Therefore, he appeared before her in his four-handed manifestation of Narayan. He got down from the bedstead, brought her up by her hands, and placing his cooling hands on her face, smoothed the scattered hairs on her head. Lord Krishna dried the wet breast of Rukmini with his hand. Understanding the seriousness of Rukmini's love for him, he embraced her to his chest. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is very expert in putting a thing reasonably for one's understanding, and thus he tried to retract all that he had said before. He is the only resort for all the devotees, and so he knows very well how to satisfy his pure devotees. Krishna understood that Rukmini could not follow the statements which he had made in a joking way. To counteract her confusion, he again began to speak as follows. My dear daughter of King Vidarbha, my dear Rukmini, please do not misunderstand me. Don't be unkind unto me like this. I know you are sincerely and seriously attached to me. You are my eternal companion. The words which have affected you so much are not factual. I wanted to irritate you a bit, and I was expecting you to make counter answers to those joking words. Unfortunately, you have taken them seriously. I am very sorry for it. I expected that your red lips would tremble in anger on hearing my statement and that you would chastise me in many words. O perfection of love, I never expected that your condition would be like this. I expected that you would put your blinking eyes upon me in retaliation, and in that way I would be able to see your beautiful face in that angry mood. My dear beautiful wife, you know that we are householders. We are always busy in many household affairs. So we long for a time when we can enjoy some joking words between us. That is the ultimate gain in the household life. Actually, the householders work hard day and night, but all fatigue of the day's labor becomes minimized as soon as they meet husband and wife together and enjoy life in many ways. Lord Krishna wanted to exhibit himself just as an ordinary householder who delights himself by exchanging joking words with his wife. He therefore repeatedly requested Rukmini not to take those words very seriously. In this way, when Lord Krishna pacified Rukmini by his sweet words, she could understand that what was formally spoken by him was not actually meant, but was spoken to evoke some joking pleasure between themselves. She was therefore pacified by hearing the words of Krishna. Gradually, she was freed from all fearfulness of separation from him, and she began to look on his face very cheerfully with her naturally smiling face. She said, "My dear lotus-eyed Lord, your statement that we are not a fit combination is completely right. It is not possible for me to come to an equal level with you because you are the reservoir of all qualities, the unlimited Supreme Personality of Godhead. How can I be a fit match for you? There is no possibility of comparison with you. You are the master of all greatness, controller of the three qualities of the object of worship, and the object of worship for the great demigods, Lord Brahma and Shiva. As far as I am concerned, I am a production of the three modes of material nature. The three modes of material nature are impediments towards the progressive advancement of devotional service. When and where can I be a fit match for you? My dear husband, you have rightly said also that being afraid of the kings, you have taken shelter in the water of the sea. But who is the king? Who is the king of this material world? I do not think that the so-called royal families are kings of the material world. The kings of the material world are the three modes of material nature. They are actually the controllers of this material world. You are situated in the core of everyone's heart, where you remain completely aloof from the touch of the three modes of material nature, and there is no doubt about it. You say you always maintain enmity with the worldly kings. But who are the worldly kings? I think that the worldly kings are the senses. They are most formidable, and they control everyone. Certainly you maintain enmity with these material senses. You are never under the control of the senses. Rather, you are the controller of the senses. Rishikesh, my dear Lord, you have said that you are bereft of all power, of all royal power, and that is also correct. Not only are you bereft of material world supremacy, but even your servants, those who have some attachment to your lotus feet, also give up the material world supremacy because they consider the material position to be the darkest region which checks the progress of spiritual enlightenment. Your servants do not like material supremacy, so what to speak of you? My dear Lord, Your statement that you do not act as an ordinary person with a particular aim in life is also perfectly correct. Even your great devotees and servants, known as great sages and saintly persons, remain in such a state that no one can get any clue to the aim of their lives. They are considered by the human society to be crazy and cynical. Their aim of life remains a mystery to the common human being. The lowest of mankind can know neither you nor your servant. A contaminated human being cannot even imagine the pastimes of you and your devotees. O unlimited one, when the activities and endeavors of your devotees remain a mystery to the common human being, how can they understand your motive and behavior? Your motive and endeavor. All kinds of energies and opulences are engaged in your service, but still they are resting at your shelter. You have described yourself as penniless, but this condition is not poverty. Since there is nothing in existence but yourself, you do not require to possess anything. You yourself are everything. Unlike others, you do not require to purchase anything extraneously. With you, all contrary things can be adjusted because you are absolute. You do not possess anything. But no one is richer than you. In the material world, no one can be rich without possessing. Since your lordship is absolute, you can adjust the contradiction of possessing nothing, but at the same time being the richest. In the Vedas, it is stated that although you have no material hands and legs, you accept everything which is offered in devotion by the devotees. You have no material eyes and ears, but still you can see everything everywhere, and you can hear everything everywhere. Although you do not possess anything, the great demigods who accept prayers and worship from others come and worship you to solicit your mercy. How can you be categorized among the poor? My dear Lord, you have also stated that the richest section of human society does not worship you. This is also correct, because persons who are puffed up with material possessions think of utilizing their property for sense gratification. When a poverty-stricken man becomes rich, he makes a program for sense gratification. This is due to his ignorance of how to utilize his hard-earned money. Under the spell of the external energy, he thinks that his money is properly employed in sense gratification, and thus he neglects to render transcendental service. My dear Lord, you have stated that persons who possess nothing are very dear to you. Renouncing everything, your devotee wants to possess you only. I see, therefore, that a great sage like Narada Muni, who does not possess any material property, is still very dear to you. And such persons do not care for anything but your lordship. My dear Lord, you have stated that a marriage between persons equal in status of social standing, beauty, riches, strength, influence, and renunciation can be a suitable match. But this status of life can only be by your grace. You are the supreme perfectional source of all opulences. Whatever opulent status of life one may have is all derived from you. As described in the Vedanta Sutra, Janmad Yasya Yataha, you are the supreme source from which everything emanates, the reservoir of all pleasures. Therefore, persons who are endowed with knowledge desire only to achieve you and nothing else. To achieve your favor, they give up everything, even the transcendental realization of Brahman. You are the supreme ultimate goal of life. You are the reservoir of all interests of all living entities. Those who are actually well motivated desire only you, and for this reason, they give up everything to attain success. They therefore deserve to be associated with you. In the society of servitors and the served in Krishna consciousness, one is not subjected to the pains and pleasures of material society, which functions according to sex attraction. Therefore, every man and woman should seek to be an associate in your society of servitors and served. You are the supreme personality of Godhead. No one can excel you, nor can anyone come up to an equal level with you. The perfect social system is that in which you remain in the center, being served as the supreme, and all others engage as your servitors. In such a perfectly constructed society, everyone can remain eternally happy and blissful. How are we doing for time? Got another page. Want to hear it, or should we stop there? Okay, finish it. My dear Lord, you have stated that only the beggars praise your glories, and that is also perfectly correct. But who are those beggars? Those beggars are all exalted devotees, liberated personalities, and those in the renounced order of life. They are all great souls and devotees who have no other business than to glorify you. Such great souls forgive even the worst offender. These so-called beggars execute their spiritual advancement of life, tolerating all kinds of tribulations in the material world. My dear husband, you do not think that out of my experience I accepted you as my Yeah, do not think that out of you do not think that out of my wait, let me read this again. My dear husband, do not think that out of my inexperience I have accepted you as my husband. Actually, I followed all those great souls. I have followed the path of these great beggars and decided to surrender my life unto your lotus feet. You have said that you are penniless, and that is correct. You distribute yourself completely to these great souls and devotees. Knowing this fact perfectly well, I have rejected even such great personalities like Lord Brahma and King Indra. My Lord, the great time factor acts under your direction only. The time factor is so great and powerful that within moments it can effect devastation anywhere within the creation. Considering all these factors, I thought Jarasandha, Sisupal, and similar other princes who wanted to marry me to be no more important than ordinary insects. My dear all-powerful son of Vasudev, your statement that you have taken shelter within the water of the ocean, being afraid of all great princes, is quite suitable. But my experience with you contradicts this. I have actually seen that you kidnapped me forcibly in the presence of all these princes. At the time of my marriage ceremony, simply by giving a jerk to the string of your bow, you very easily drove the others away and kindly gave me shelter at your lotus feet. I still remember vividly that you kidnapped me in the same way as a lion forcibly takes his share of hunted booty, driving away all of the small animals within the twinkling of an eye. My dear lotus-eyed Lord, I cannot understand your statement that women and other persons who have taken shelter under your lotus feet pass their days only in bereavement. From the history of the world, we can see that princes like Anga, Prithu, Bharat, Yayati, and Gaya were all great emperors of the world, and there were no competitors to their exalted positions. But in order to achieve the favor of your lotus feet, they renounced their exalted positions and entered into the forest to practice penances and austerities. When they voluntarily accepted such a position, accepting your lotus feet as all in all, does it mean that they were in lamentation and bereavement? My dear Lord, you have advised me that I can still select another from the princely order and divorce myself of your companionship. But my dear Lord, it is perfectly well known to me that you are the reservoir of all good qualities. Great saintly persons like Narada Muni are always engaged simply in glorifying your transcendental characteristics. If someone simply takes shelter of such a saintly person, he immediately becomes freed from all material contamination. And by coming in direct contact with your service, the goddess of fortune agrees to bestow all her blessings. Under the circumstances, what woman who has once heard of your glories from authoritative sources and somehow or other has tasted the nectarian flavor of your lotus feet can be foolish enough to agree to marry someone of this material world who is always afraid of death, disease, old age, and rebirth? I have therefore accepted your lotus feet, not without consideration, but after mature and deliberate decision. My dear Lord, you are the master of the three worlds. You can fulfill all desires of all your devotees in this world and the next. Because you are the supreme soul of everyone, because you are the supreme soul of everyone, I have therefore selected you as my husband, considering you to be the only fit personality. You may throw me in any species of life according to the reaction of my fruitive activities, and I haven't the least concern for this. My only ambition is that I may always remain fast to your lotus feet, because you can deliver your devotees from the illusory material existence and are always prepared to distribute yourself to your devotees. Just a little bit more now. My dear Lord, you have advised me to select one of the princes such as Sisupal, Jarasandha, or Dantavakra. But what is their position in this world? They are always engaged in hard labor to maintain their household life, just like the bulls working hard day and night with the oil-pressing machine. They are compared to asses, beasts of burden. They are always dishonored like the dogs, and they are miserly like the cats. They have sold themselves like slaves to their wives. Any unfortunate woman who has never heard of your glories may accept such a man as her husband. But a woman who has learned about you, that you are praised not only in this world, but in the halls of the great demigods like Brahma and Lord Shiva, and will not accept anyone besides yourself as her husband. I might have read that wrong. But anyway, just as if they hear about Krishna, you won't accept anyone besides him as your husband. A man within this material world is just a dead body. In fact, superficially, the living entity is covered by this body, which is nothing but a bag of skin decorated with beards and mustaches, hairs on the body, nails on the fingers, and hairs on the head. Within this decorated bag, there are bunches of muscles, bundles of bones, and pools of blood, always mixed up with stool, urine, mucus, bile, and polluted air. and enjoyed by different kinds of insects and germs. A foolish woman accepts such a dead body as her husband, and in sheer misunderstanding loves him in her loves him as her dear companion. This is only possible because such a woman has never tasted the ever blissful flavor of your lotus feet. My dear lotus-eyed husband, you are self-satisfied. You do not care whether or not I am beautiful or qualified. You are not at all concerned about it. Therefore, your non-attachment for me is not at all astonishing. It is quite natural. You cannot be attached to any woman, however exalted her position and beauty. Whether you are attached to me or not, may my devotion and attention be always engaged at your lotus feet. The material mode of passion is also your creation, so when you passionately glance upon me, I accept it as the greatest boon of my life. I am ambitious only for such auspicious moments. And that's the end. Haribo. So, appearance day of Sri Rukmini Ki Jai.